All right, good afternoon. Is there still a little bit of energy in the room? Okay, I know we're getting towards the end. All right, cool. I'm Xavier Buck, and as it was said earlier, I'm the executive director of the Dr. Huey P. Newton Foundation. Raise your hands, who knows who Huey P. Newton is? Okay. In his time, he was quite a polarizing figure. He co-founded the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in 1966 in Oakland, California. And I work with his widow, who co-founded this foundation to preserve and promote the legacy of the Black Panther Party. This organization has been around since 1995. And the original catalyst for it was that his widow was left this large archive. And she really did not know what to do with it. Quite honestly, she had been running away from this legacy because so many of her friends, her comrades, had been killed. And her herself had a lot of trauma from being under surveillance by the FBI. Thankfully, they did strike a deal with Stanford University Libraries, and that's where the archive, the collection has been housed since the 95-96, and we still own the intellectual property. And so we work closely with Stanford University Libraries, where it is one of the most visited collections at the university. Now, I've been asked to talk a little bit about narrative control and the business of legacy keeping. And I've quite honestly been struggling in my head to figure out what to say, not because I have a lack of words, but because we just had a regime shift in this country. And it has already begun to directly impact the work that we do. The Black Panther Party was painted as thugs, as hoodlums, as terrorists. The FBI director J. Edgar Hoover said himself that they were the greatest threat to the internal security of the nation. Anybody heard of COINTELPRO? Does that ring a bell? COINTELPRO was the FBI's formal program, and I'll give you their words, to discredit, disrupt, and destroy Black leaders. Their words, they wanted to prevent another Black Messiah. Rosa Parks had an FBI file under this program. Martin Luther King had an FBI file under this program. Every single Panther had an FBI file under this program. And under these conditions, and I'll tell you the stories the Panthers have told me themselves, is that they were under constant surveillance. They knew when their phones were tapped because you would hear a clicking noise. Also, now that we, through the Freedom of Information Act, have a lot of redacted FBI files, we know that FBI informants were even listening to them having sexual relations. These were teenagers, average age 19 years old, the Panthers were. So there was intense surveillance, there was intense harassment. Many people were incarcerated. The first SWAT team in America was created in Los Angeles to raid the LA chapter's office. Just a few months before they assassinated a leader in the Chicago chapter, Fred Hampton, who you might have heard of. This is what our US government did to any movement, any Black movement, and any movement on the left, specifically in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but the program COINTELPRO was merely refined by the time we got to that era. J. Edgar Hoover had been a part of the FBI since 1919 with the Palmer Raids. And the reason I kind of am foregrounding the conversation in this, because I will get to the humanities part, or the digital humanities part, but I foreground it because that's why narrative control is so important to us. When I tell you that the FBI was able to set the stage and say, these are terrorists, that changed everything. When the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, says they are the greatest threat to internal security of the nation, it's not because it was true. Nobody can go against the US military. Right, especially not a scrappy group of teenagers out of Oakland, but it was a way to greenlight law enforcement agencies to attack Panthers all over the nation. And then there's this author named, or this historian named Curtis Austin out of Ohio State, and his research found that he believes that at least 70% of the media articles put out about the party while they were in existence, this is from 1966 to 1982, that 70% of those articles were either penned by or influenced by the FBI. So even in the Black Panther Party's afterlife, we have to be very careful about what kind of collections we're using, what kind of sources we're using to tell these stories. And so this organization has kind of been a beacon light, a counter to that program that our government had on the party, and a way to rectify the stories that were mistold. And so that's one reason why the collection we house at Stanford is so important. That's one reason the Black Panther newspaper that they had, which was the most read Black newspaper of its time, 300,000 copies per week circulated around the US. That's why that's so important. And that's why the work of the Huey P. Newton Foundation is so important. So I just kind of wanted to foreground you guys in that, in When we think about digital humanities and we think about the business of it, we have a very different task at hand. We have a task at staying loud enough to make sure the community knows what we're doing and get the message out, but staying quiet enough to stay away from any kind of surveillance from our government or other law enforcement agencies. So some of our initiatives, just this year, we opened up the Black Panther Party Museum in downtown Oakland. That's a 3,000 square foot facility right now with two exhibitions. And later in 2025, we'll have a complete redesign by the architect who did the Hip Hop Museum in the Bronx. So we're very excited about that. We're open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 3, if you guys want to stop by. But also, we just received an Andrew Mellon Foundation grant to start digitizing that collection that's housed at Stanford and bring it into the museum. That way that it's accessible to folks in Oakland who might not be able to get all the way down to Palo Alto and go through the kind of barriers that can happen going, you know, when you're checking at the library. It can be a little intense sometimes. And not necessarily welcoming. And so we're building a community research room at the museum where folks can interact. You can have your coffee, you can have conversations while you're looking at the digital materials. We also have a national park campaign. We have several sites in Oakland and around the Bay Area that preserve this history, and for better or for worse, still look like the eras they were created in. And so we have a chance to interpret those sites. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. What else do we have? We just created a curriculum about the Black Panther Party history for 3rd through 12th graders. We hired 10 curriculum developers, 10 in Oakland, sorry, 5 in Oakland, 5 from across the country. So that's another way to think about how do we get this information out to the public? Can we get school districts to adopt this information? Can it just be available online in a private way so that the masses can have access to it? And we've also produced virtual reality experiences, doing tours around Oakland and giving folks a chance to put on their headsets and actually immerse themselves in the history of the party. So these are all some of the works. These are all part of the work that we do at the Dr. Huey P. Newton Foundation. We've also excited because we're trying to work with Wayne and his company because those Black Panther newspapers are the best source for learning about the party. And we've already digitized them, but they're not indexed. You can't search them. And so we're hoping through OCR technology, we'll be able to extract information from these newspapers and create databases that can help us with anything from GIS mapping to creating AI chatbots so that people can interact with this history. So that's kind of how we're thinking. We're thinking outside of the box all the time, just because of the legacy of this organization and what we feel like we're up against. In 2016, we had received a $100,000 grant from the National Park Service to just collect oral histories about the Black Power era in the Bay Area. And it was in collaboration with Dr. Eula Taylor, who was at that time chair of African Studies at UC Berkeley. And unfortunately, while we were told we would get the grant under the Obama administration, the actual implementation of the grant was under the Trump administration. And the largest police union in the nation wrote a letter to Donald Trump, once again rebranding the Black Panther Party as a terrorist organization and saying that this is not a story that the National Park should ever tell. This is not an American story, it's an anti-American story. That's what the letter says. You could look up the articles. And so it became a very real fear for us, right? Especially with this regime change with Trump in office again. Of us having to be very careful about how we do things. And so it's unfortunate. I wish I had better news, but the National Park campaign had to be put on pause. Mostly because, not that it's over, not that these sites can't be preserved, not that we can't go through a state park process, but because that could put a target on our organization's back. And all the other initiatives that we have in these digital humanities to get this information out could be at jeopardy. And so, and even more importantly, when I think about narrative control, it would give Trump, the federal government, police agencies the opportunity to control the narrative of the party again on a national stage. And so let me tell you who the party was. They started off just Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, two community college students in Oakland who were primarily concerned with police brutality. We saw what happened with Breonna Taylor, in Kentucky. Law enforcement had the wrong address on their warrant. They went into her home and she was killed. But when the Black Panther Party, when Huey and Bobby went around Oakland and Richmond, And they went door to door doing kind of community engagement and needs assessment. What they found is that police officers were going into black folks' homes without any warrant, period, often taking guns out of their homes and often brutalizing them, on top of the plenty of people who were shot dead in the streets or harassed. And so they wanted to deal with police brutality head on. So they would have a shotgun in one hand and a law book in the other, we'll put it like that, because the Black Panther Party never stepped outside of their legal boundaries. Huey self-taught himself everything he needed to know about California law. And so they knew at that time they could stand 15 feet from a police officer and watch what they were doing. Just watch. They often had unloaded weapons, but weapons nonetheless, and would say something if folks were being harassed. That's kind of how the organization started, but then it grew because when you get to the root causes of things like police brutality or the things that black folk were going through in Oakland and across this country, it really had to do with capitalism and its byproduct of poverty. And so they started 65 survival programs, the most well-known being the free breakfast program for school children. They started free medical clinics. They started free ambulance services. Nobody at that time was testing for sickle cell, so they started a sickle cell research center and started testing thousands of people. Because of that, the American Red Cross increased their funding for sickle cell from $10,000 to $250,000. We know the prisons in California are in rural parts of the state, and even though the majority of people they were locking up were black and brown people from the cities, and so that breaks up families. So they sponsored free buses between the cities and the prisons so families wouldn't be broken up. They had things as simple as free pest control, because why are people living with rats and roaches just because they're poor? Not of any fault of their own, but because of the system that we live under. And so this was the Black Panther Party. These were folks who didn't wear leather jackets and berets every single day, often wore regular clothes, and were serving the community. And so the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, when he said they were the greatest threat to the internal security of the nation, he said, it's not the guns, you can look up, these are his words. He says, it's not the guns that I'm afraid of. It's the free breakfast program. Because when you give food to the kids, all of a sudden they're gonna ask questions. And the main question they're gonna start, the point of inquiry they're gonna have is how can the wealthiest nation in the world do so little with so much, and this scrappy group of teenagers can do so much with so little? That all of a sudden makes you question the entire economic system you live under and why you are under these conditions. And so those programs, those 65 programs, became organizing tools. They became a way to elect the first black mayor in Oakland. It became a way to entirely break up the white political machine that was in Oakland and all around this country. And so there was a tie between that. So that's the stories that we're looking to highlight. Those are the stories that we're trying to provide to the masses, the blueprint of what the Black Panther Party did. Not the narrative that they were given, not the narrative that was controlled by the federal government, but the one that actually comes from them, the one that was done out of love, not anger. And so, I don't know how to end this conversation, but you know, I think that the work of the Digital Humanities is more important now than ever, especially for us. And what I'm constantly thinking about, now having an institution in downtown Oakland, a museum, is how do we take this grant money, this donor money, what I see as seed money, and we become self-sufficient, right? How do we make sure we don't have to be reliant on anyone again? And how do we make sure that we maintain control over the narrative despite all the different factors in place? And so this is some of the work that we do, and this is the ways that we often think differently. And so I just appreciate everybody that's contributed to the room. I really enjoyed the presentations this afternoon, and that's my contribution to the day. Thank you.